Okay, so we left it by saying that for an estimate of a mean value, a system mean, we could construct an interval around that estimate where for some large percentage of the time our actual system mean would lie within that interval. We did that by observing that our system mean estimate was the average, sample average of a lot of IID random variables. And observing that the central limit theorem said that that sort of a distribution was going to have a normal, the sample average, so taking the sum of a bunch of IID variables gave you a normal distribution. Okay. That is, of course, dependent on us having enough samples. If we don't, then if we have a smaller number of samples, we can look at a different distribution known as the student's T distribution. And this will represent the distribution of a smaller number of, the sum of a smaller number of these random variables. Okay, it's not, it won't give us as tight an interval. There's a Irish, I guess.
I have a question on this figure. Like in the last example, when you showed 1.96, mm-hmm. and you showed us the table, and the value was 0.4750, what is that exactly?
The 0.475 was the proportion of the population, so out of one in that case, so 47.5%, that was from the mean to the 1.96 standard deviations.
Okay.
So what we were looking for is we wanted to catch 95% of the population, but our distribution was only giving us halves of that, so we had to halve what we were looking for.
Is it the same thing?
Not quite. We'll go over the table. That is a bit of local history about the student's T. This distribution was created by a Dubliner. I think his name was Gossin. But he was working for Guinness's at the time. And so as such, he was forbidden from publishing results under his own name because Guinness didn't want them. The competition was a trade secret, didn't want the competition to know that they were doing essentially statistical analysis on their product to sort of improve quality. So he was very proud of the results, so he published it under the name of a student instead, and that's where students comes from, in the student T distribution. Okay. Anyway, it's used for smaller sample values. And it is dependent on what's called the degrees of freedom. And for the purposes of this calculation, our degrees of freedom are the number of samples we take minus one. Okay. So if you have your observed value and you know n minus one of the samples, you can recreate your last one, so you have n minus one to play with, and then the last one is fixed by your value. Okay. So, again, our probability is going to be it's on half the sides, and now we're looking not at the middle, but at the edges, so the value is greater than a certain point. Okay. So, in our chart here, you have your degrees of freedom, and so once you fix the degrees of freedom, then you have a similar multiple of your standard deviation. And so these values give the multiple of the standard deviation. Okay. And that's mapped against what proportion of the population is now greater than that value. Okay. So, if we have 11 samples, that fixes our standard deviation at 10. And we say we want a 95% confidence level. That means that you want at most 0.05 outside the range. We're only looking at half one side of that range, so you want half of the values outside of that range. So you want 0.025 outside of that range. And then the body of the chart gives you your multiplier. Okay. So this would say that, again, if you want 90 to encompass 95%, then it should be between plus and minus 2.22 standard deviations around the mean. Okay. So again, our estimate of standard deviation is S over the square root of n, and then we have the 2.2. 8 as our multiplier. Okay. So there's less certainty in this calculation, so you get wider ranges. Okay, so before we had 1.96, now it's 2.28. 2.228. Okay. And you can note that as your your number of samples, in this case, as it corresponds to the degrees of freedom, gets larger, then the student's T distribution converges eventually to a normal distribution. But for our purposes, we're only going to use it if we have a small number of samples. So we said around 30 was good for normal distribution, so if you have less than that, you'll use the student's T. Okay. So it's the same idea, slightly different distribution, and naturally different tables. So are you happy with how the table works, then.
Yeah, one more thing. What is like? What is the relation between N and this first column? N and first column, degree of freedom.
N minus 1 is going to be your degrees of freedom. So if you have N samples, you have N minus 1 degrees of freedom.
And what is this then?
So that's just an example. So I said
for us,
we've gathered 11 samples. So then N is 11 minus 1. Or, no. N is 11.
Yeah.
The degrees of freedom is 10. So N minus 1. Sorry about that. Okay. Okay. So that gives us this, again, this core concept of confidence intervals. And we applied this, we looked at how that worked for mean values. We can look at other system parameters, so we can look at something like the probability that a random variable lies in some interval. And so that's something on the order of trying to estimate our probability density functions. Okay. Yeah, we have the idea of percentiles, and then variance. So we can do similar things with each of these. And so again, what we'd like to do is take multiple samples, average them, that generates your normal random variable, and from there, a confidence interval. And that works pretty well for both the probability and the percentiles. You do have some issues then with variance that we'll get to. Okay. So we want the probability that a random variable lies in an interval. And again, you can think of this as sort of trying to develop some sort of distribution in your function. So you do that. Over a number of intervals, then again, you're going to roughly see the curve of your distribution. Okay. And so, again, it should be relatively straightforward to gather that sort of information from your trace. You just, again, observe how many of them actually are in whatever area. So we can ask, for instance, what's the probability of a customer waiting more than 5 minutes for service? And so obviously for a run, we have a certain number of customers, a certain number of those have waited more than 5 minutes, and the ratio of those numbers gives us our sample estimate. And we can run that over, again, more than one run of the trace of the system. Okay. And so there's a number of ways you can, again, gather that from the system. We can gather our observations and then directly do a count, And then again, your probability is just going to be that count over the total. Okay. And you, yeah, given that, you know, that's your average, and then you can have an estimated standard deviation. Okay, and use those values then to arrive at a confidence interval. Okay, you could also do this sort of as a running tally, which is essentially all that says. Okay, so again, you just extract the information from your simulation, and then assuming that, again, your IID conditions hold, your you can construct confidence intervals to decide how happy you are with that estimate. Okay. Percentiles, again, it's just a matter of extracting your values from the system. Okay. Okay, so, you know, again, we had our example of a 95th percentile value, so what's the value for which 95% are lower than that value? So you can use that to query things like waiting times. So yeah, on the assumption that you want perhaps 95% of your customers to be happy anyway. Okay. So again, you have to order your, you have to extract your values and then order them, and again, just count up to 95% of your values. You can do that for each run of the simulation, each simulation run, and then take the average of that, of, you know, the observed values, and estimate of a standard deviation, and calculate your confidence interval. So same technique. Now, gathering appropriate statistics is going to depend on sort of exactly what percentile value do you want. And so if you're looking for extremes, obviously you're going to have to take longer and longer runs to get the appropriate number of samples to be appropriately significant. Okay, so in terms of gathering that data, you can always, again, store your observations to the end of the run and then process them. Or if you have some idea of the range, you can, again, try and build up something like a histogram and sort of, again, by determining what point you're at in the histogram. You should be able to extract a value. Okay, so those, again, those estimates of occurrences in an interval, estimates of percentiles work exactly in the same way as the estimate of the mean does, in terms of, you know, calculating confidence intervals and being happy. Variance is a bit more complicated. Okay. So, we first, of course, need to estimate our for each run, we're going to have to estimate the mean, and then, of course, the distribution around the mean. Okay. So, for each, we have a number of runs, and for each run here, we have a number of samples, and then we want to estimate a mean and a variance for those samples. Okay. So for any given run, we have mu hat of I, so our estimate of the mean is just given by the by averaging our samples. Okay. We can then estimate the system mean by averaging our means. And now if we try to calculate, we can calculate the variance for any given trace, and we get SI squared, so it's just the samples minus your mean squared, and expanding that out, we get this quantity. So if we that gives us an estimate of the variance for each run, and then we want to take the estimate for the system. But what we observe is that each of our system estimates is a function of our mean, and therefore there is correlation between the different estimates. Okay, so you can't assume that each estimate is independent, therefore the things we've been talking about, the central limit theorem, which requires independence, isn't going to hold. Okay, so if you wish to estimate variance, you're going to have to deal with the correlations between your sample estimates. Okay. And so Paros, again, suggests the form which you will need to use to essentially remove that correlation. And so we develop signalized I's squared, which are estimates, leaving out the I replication. From that, we find Zi, and we can then use the average of that Z, a calculation of S squared based on that Z. And if you do a reasonable amount of work, you can demonstrate that that's, that does give us an uncorrelated estimates. Okay, so in general, I won't ask you to do that, but just be aware that if you do want to do it, you do have to do a little bit more work. Okay, so what we have now is that we've discussed a combination of how you would measure various quantities over a single trace, how you use multiple observations over a number of traces to arrive at an overall system estimate, and then sort of some idea of how good is our estimate relative to the unknown actual value. We've assumed in each of these cases that essentially each of our samples corresponded to a different simulation run, and those simulations were run long enough that you were actually observing steady state behavior and not transient behavior. There are, again, a number of ways in which you can actually gather these independent observations or samples. Okay, so again, the problem with looking at a single trace is that values that are close together will be correlated. So you have to again look over long periods of time to vary that correlation. Okay. So when we can extract our data, there's again a number of methods of doing this. Replication refers to this idea of just keep running the simulation over and over again. Batch means you don't necessarily have to keep restarting the simulation. And again, Paris will mention a third technique of regenerative technique that relies on the system always returning to a specific value, a specific point. So it's a bit more, but it may or may not be applicable, so we won't bother with it. Okay. So, again, the easiest thing is our replication method, or at least the conceptually easiest. So we just run the simulation n times, and then we can calculate our sample means and our sample variances or deviations. Okay. You have to be careful that for each of your runs you have reached your steady state within the run. Okay. So one question that you might be interested in is how many runs will it take to achieve a specific confidence interval? So we've observed that the more runs you have, the sort of tighter you are around your mean. And so,
well, you do this by observing the behavior sort of to a certain point. So, first cut, we perform a certain number of runs, and we can calculate the confidence interval. Okay. So, that's a multiplier times sigma. So you can compare your current value to your desired value, and again, you're going to decrease with 1 over the square root of n. So again, you just need to calculate what value of n you need to shrink that interval. If you're going from this, again, this is probably more sensible if you're already talking about being in the normal range. Otherwise, again, the student's T will also tighten just with the number of the interval tighten just with the number of degrees of freedom increasing. Okay. So another possibility is to perform the run continuously and just keep track. You can calculate the confidence interval on the fly and then just keep track of that until you reach your desired level. So another technique used is what's called the batch means method. So again, it might be, maybe your system has a long transient period, so you're spending a lot of time sort of moving out off the transient. And so the batch means method gives you a way of extracting independent samples from a single trace. Okay. And it's exactly what you would think. You divide your observations up into a number, you divide your trace up into a number of batches, each of the same length, and you calculate your estimate on each of the given batches. Okay, you then use that. So that gives you your sample values, and you average your sample values over the number of batches you have to give your system estimates. Okay. And so if you can convince yourself that each of your sample estimates is independent from the next, then there's no reason that you shouldn't do that. Okay. The drawback is that your sample values from which you're calculating your estimate, so say this is Q length, are correlated. So again, there's correlation from one batch to the next. But again, if you run the batches long enough, that correlation dies away. So you need to make sure that your batch lengths are long enough that you don't, that the distributions are at least by and large uncorrelated. Okay.
So, again, you have the question before you asked, what number of runs do I need? It's the exact same question now. What number of batches do I need? So essentially, how many sample estimates do I need? Okay. And you can either do that by running for a fixed period of time, making a calculation, and then running for the length of time that your calculation says you need, or, again, do that on the fly so that you can just keep running your simulation. Okay. Okay, so I think I actually deleted this slide from the ones I posted, or I'll just make a note that if you do have correlation between your samples, then it is possible in some cases to sort of correct the correlation, so remove that correlation factor to, again, produce samples that look uncorrelated. But, I don't really, I actually didn't intend to get into that, and I seem to only have one slide left on it, so we'll just leave that as a note of sort of, again, further complications that you can deal with. Okay, so again, that's pretty much the core of what we want to do today. It's something that I think you do need to sort of sit down and think about this idea of what exactly we need to estimate, and the idea of why we need to estimate over a number of samples, and then, of course, the production of our confidence intervals. Okay. We'll take up the idea of validating at least portions of our model next time. And so the idea here is, if you create a simulation model, so okay, we've measured these quantities. The question is, how do we convince ourselves that what we're simulating is actually what we intended? Okay. And so there's a number of techniques to check sort of various portions of the system. Input validity typically is a matter of checking the distributions for your input. So again, these random variates that you've generated, and we'll talk about that next lecture. So I've generated this string of numbers. What do I need to do to convince myself so that it actually looks like it has a certain
distribution, could have been drawn from a certain distribution. Okay. And, you know, what we'll see is that it's a similar idea. You can never be 100% sure, but we can put numbers on, you know, the likelihood of the fit. If we have an actual system, an existing system, then we can possibly check the output of our simulation against the system. Okay, so if you can observe output for the system, you can gather statistics on the actual data and compare those to statistics for your output. And beyond that, you've got sort of work to do in checking sort of the model itself and, you know, convincing yourself that the simulation logic that you produced is what you wanted to produce. And again, a lot of times that's approached that, you know, again, the model is a simplification of the system. So can we sort of map the complexity of the system down into the simplification, and do we understand how that mapping is working? So those are the sort of ideas. We're going to confine ourselves probably to looking at just one of those checking, again, distributions. I won't bother really talking about it now. We'll spend the lecture next time going over that. So that's it for today. As always, have a good weekend.